This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today I am speaking with author Susan Orlean. She's written many books and numerous magazine articles for publications including Rolling Stone, Esquire, Vogue, Women's Outside, Spy, The Boston Phoenix, and Globe. Of course, The New Yorker, where she has been a staff writer since 1992. Two of her articles have inspired movies. The Orchid Thief for The New Yorker inspired the movie adaptation, and Life Swell for Women's Outside magazine inspired Blue Crush, a female surfer movie. On her website, www.susanorlean.com, she describes herself as an author, a dog owner, a gardener, a parent, a frequent lecturer, speaker, an occasional teacher, and a very occasional guest editor. Welcome, Susan.
Nice to be with you.
I'm glad you are. And there's certainly going to be a lot to talk about during our time today. Out here, we're really interested in sustainability. And one of the articles you wrote for The New Yorker in 2009 has stayed with me for years now. It's the one called The It Bird, The Return of the Backyard Chicken. And you start with an anecdote about how you became interested in having chickens, and you end with your assurance that raising chickens is here to stay. So, of course, I'm wondering if you're still raising chickens.
I was still raising chickens until they were all massacred in a very unhappy aspect of chicken ownership, which is that chickens are the favorite food of many, many, many creatures. And we had a raccoon that broke into our coop and killed all the chickens, came back the next night and killed all my guinea fowl, and I have not replaced them yet because I spend half of my time in Los Angeles where it's not very convenient to have chickens, and the rest of my time in New York where it really is convenient to have chickens. So I've been trying to figure out if I can have a chicken nanny to step in when I'm away from our farm.
In the feature that you wrote about being inspired to raise the chickens, you do talk about bringing one of the chickens to the vet because the chicken was quite ill, and about the man who was so surprised to see that inside your cat carrier wasn't a cat, but a chicken. And I know it also broke your heart then when a couple of the chickens were destroyed by animals. So it's challenging.
It is. It's the real first lesson I think anyone has who decides to have any kind of livestock. Poultry in particular are very vulnerable, and there has yet to be invented the predator-proof chicken coop. And if you want your chickens to have a sort of quality of life where they're able to walk around and scratch and eat bugs and have some freedom, they're going to get killed. And they may not all get killed, but you will lose them. It's nature. And in the beginning, the first time I lost some, I was absolutely devastated. I cried for days. The next time that I lost one, I began to recognize that this was part of the experience, and not a happy part, but a part that is unavoidable. And you do get a little inured to the sadness. If you're somebody like me, for whom the chickens were partly pets, I had a number that was small enough that I knew them all. Mm. And I knew their personalities. And, you know, once you start having 50 chickens or 100 chickens, your relationship with them probably changes. But when you have 8 or 10, they're real individuals to you.
Yeah.
And you miss them when they die.
So my question is, have you written more about them, even though you're not raising chickens anymore?
I wrote a little essay that was in a photography book that was published this year. I generally don't revisit topics, and that was a bit unusual for me to go back and write again about them. I usually am more interested in moving on to the next.
Interesting story. That's reflected in the number of magazine articles and books you've written. But I did come across an article, another one for The New Yorker, that you wrote 2 years later after the first one about chickens called Chicken Chores. It was a short piece. And I was very taken with a metaphor that comes up. You're comparing the messiness of feeding and watering the chickens every morning to the idea that we need balance in our lives, that we seek perfection so much that it's wonderful to have this messy chore that we don't have to worry about finishing. You don't have to worry about finishing because it's going to happen every day, and you don't have to worry about being neat. And can I read to you the metaphor to writing that I just really love? You say, at their messiest and most burdensome, these chicken chores please me. It's a concrete need, water, to which I can respond specifically, here you go, birds, water. And the cycle is complete, until they need water again, of course. In so many endeavors, including writing, you are never done and nothing is ever perfect. You are haunted always by the possibility that you could have done more and better. It's a relief sometimes to take on a task and see it through and know it to be wholly sufficient. And I'm sure you feel that way about gardening as well, which is one of the things of your interests. And what do you want to say these days, now that you're not feeding chickens, about the need for some messiness in life and maybe even in writing?
Well, I think that the satisfaction of a very concrete task is a great balance to the challenge of a creative endeavor like writing. There is no concrete achievement that you can aim for in writing. You have the general, rather overwhelming challenge of wanting to write the very best piece you can possibly write, the very best book you can possibly write. But there is never a moment when a bell goes off and you know you've accomplished that very specific task. I think as a result, a lot of people who are engaged in these creative fields find real comfort in undertakings that are physical, like taking care of animals, gardening, cooking, but also that it's a punch list. You have a list of tasks and you achieve them, and it's very, very satisfying, and you can feel that it's complete. You feel that you have done it perfectly. You have gone, and someone would say, well, with gardening, with live things, there's never anything perfect. So I understand that. But if your chickens are hungry, you go out and feed them and you clean their coop and it's nice and clean, you feel satisfied. It's a very good, solid feeling of satisfaction. With writing, even though there, of course, are moments when you feel transported and happy and accomplished, there is always the feeling that you can be better, that you can do better, that you could do one more interview or perfect the sentence, or it's never done. And that's part of what makes it fascinating and also something that can sometimes make it extremely frustrating.
Well, I might add the audience difference. When you feed the chickens, they're going to be appreciative. They're going to love what you're doing. And I think when you write as an author, there's always this idea that, well, who's going to read it? Who's going to like it? Why will they read it? All these things. But when it comes to a task like feeding chickens, the gratification is, I think, partly that you've made these beings really happy.
Oh, yeah. This is a great feeling. And I think that's a lot of why we have such a strong connection to animals, is there is a purity of their response. I think you can get that feeling with humans as well. If you cook a meal for your family and everybody's really happy and loves it, it's a great feeling. When you write a book, it's an endless process of, I don't want to say process of disappointment because that sounds so pessimistic, but you're throwing out into the universe this thing you've created, and you will never have a very specific, concrete experience of the three people sitting at dinner saying, oh, this is delicious. Mm. You get a good review, you get a bad review, you sell a lot of copies, but then you have a few copies that get remaindered. And I don't think any writer who has any degree of self-doubt, which would be 100% of all writers, would ever say, oh, I had a perfect experience. I wrote a perfect story. The response was universally positive, and I am utterly satisfied. I just don't think it happens. And I think it would be scary if it happened. I don't think that's the way the world works.
Right. Nonetheless, you've written dozens and dozens of articles for well-known magazines and newspapers, and I think people will be interested to know how your career started and what you think the factors are that made it flourish so.
My career started right out of college. I knew I wanted to write. I didn't particularly know how to make it happen, and I really was planning just to spend a year doing odds and ends before heading to law school, which I had kind of been pressed to do by my parents, who felt that it was a safe option for somebody who had a degree in liberal arts. I never wanted to be a lawyer, I should point out, but it was seen as the fallback for people who studied literature, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. But I lucked into a writing job at a very small publication in Portland. I was hired not by any power of my experience. I had no experience, but I had enormous desire. I wanted to be a writer. This was a little startup publication, so they couldn't exactly go hiring people with lots of experience, but I just went into the interview and said, I want to do this more than I want to do anything. You've got to hire me. And they did. It kind of followed from there. I worked in Portland at these alternative newsweeklies for 4 years. I then began freelancing for bigger magazines, eventually moving to Boston and then to New York, and building on my experience to move up the food chain of publications, and then also began thinking about and eventually actually diving into the world of writing books. I think it's flourished because, number one, I really do love what I do, and I have a real, I feel like it's a drive and a mission that is absolutely innate, and I love words, and I'm very curious, and it's somehow, then there's a something that you can't put your finger on, and you don't know why does it work. For me, I've had many wonderful mentors. I've had some really great opportunities that I jumped on, and it's fit together. Looking backward, it looks like, wow, this was a very smooth path. Along the way, it was a lot of invention and using chewing gum and Band-Aids to piece it together, because I had no idea how you went about making a career as a writer.
Which is why your parents wanted you to be a lawyer, no doubt.
Yes, exactly.
You are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender on KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. Today, Sheila is talking with Susan Orlean, staff writer for The New Yorker and nonfiction author.
Do you have any example of a Band-Aid or a toothpick approach to what comes next with a writer who's just starting?
Well, I always felt from the beginning that I needed to just write as much as possible, and that meant not holding out till I had an assignment from the fanciest, most prestigious place, but just trying to write as much as I possibly could. And it meant writing for very small publications in the beginning, for magazines that weren't especially literary, women's magazines. But I just felt like it was important to write as much as I possibly could. And I definitely urge that when I talk to people who are aspiring writers, to just get out there, get published, and experience the process of writing and the process of being edited and the process of being published. And then as you get that kind of experience, you begin to focus on your goal of where you really want to write and what you really want to write about.
And for you, that turned out to be what?
The New Yorker primarily was my goal. That's where I wanted to write. That's what the tone and spirit of the writing that I really wanted to do. And I wanted to write books and write books that reflected my philosophy on what's important and how I wanted to write about it.
And a lot of those books have to do with interesting things about people and also about animals. So I was wondering how you would describe the difference between writing articles and writing books.
The difference is profound. One is a commitment that's, in many cases, several years. It involves engaging a reader with a story that's going to stretch over, say, 300 pages, which means a huge amount of thinking about structure and about purpose and about narrative. In a way, an article is just a miniature of that, but an article is delivered within the pages of an existing institution like the New Yorker or the Smithsonian Magazine, or you don't have to sell it quite the way a book needs to sell itself, and I mean that kind of metaphorically. A book has to argue with the reader about why it's worth $29 and, say, 20 hours of their time. An article doesn't require quite so much and doesn't have to stand on its own quite the same way. So the pressures of writing a book are quite different and have so much to do with keeping people's attention in a busy world.
Right. I know that a lot of online magazines now tell you how long it will take you at your particular reading speed to finish an article. A minute, 5 minutes, 15. So we're all very
right.
time conscious. That idea that we can lose ourselves in a book and forget about time is wonderful, but also vanishing. And maybe
right.
you could tell us about Rin Tin Tin as a book in terms of how you knew you would be able to engage readers.
Well, I began, as I do with every book, just feeling this tremendous excitement and curiosity about the subject. I just thought, what is this story? This is fascinating. I wasn't even thinking about readers in the beginning. I just thought, I want to learn this story. This is amazing. And in my gut, I thought, I think a lot of people would be interested in this. It immediately spoke to me as a book. And it was, it's not the most obvious topic when you consider that this is an iconic figure that has largely faded from public attention. Almost all the characters that I was writing about were dead. So it was something that as I began working on it, I was more and more aware of the challenge I had set for myself. But from the beginning, my gut feeling was, this is such a wonderful story. I also knew that anything having to do with animals was going to have a dimension that would really interest me, and I know people like reading about animals. That's just a given. They do. So I felt this sense that I could engage people, even if they said, gee, I have no idea who Rin Tin Tin is. There was so much history, and the great discovery that I've made in the last couple of years and in the course of doing that book is people love reading a history told in an interesting way through a specific narrative. It's fascinating to me how much people love it. We think everybody's interested in what's the here and the now and the moment. But people really respond to that, and I learned that when I wrote The Orchid Thief. I kind of imagined that some of the history of orchid hunting would be a very much a secondary part of the book. I just didn't know if people would be that interested in it, and I was surprised to discover how much people loved it, how much they were interested in it, and frankly, that they wished there had been more.
Mm-hmm.
So when I started working on Rin Tin Tin, which three quarters of it was history, I had the confidence of thinking, you know, yes, this happened a long time ago, but it's a great story, and I think people love learning history if it's told in a really engaging way.
I agree, and stories are timeless. For instance, the Bible, if you think of it as literature, has stories that people love to return to and are stories that are very contemporary in human interactions and feelings.
Yeah.
So you brought up The Orchid Thief, which is another favorite of mine. Very taken with your article. The beginning of the book, which I guess you could say the beginning of the book was the article that you wrote for The New Yorker. And then, of course, the fact that two of your articles have inspired filmmakers, and The Orchid Thief is one. And anyone who's seen it knows that there's a fictionalized version of you in that movie. And I was wondering what that feels like to you as an author and a woman to have seen this portrayal.
Well, I love the movie, and I never thought that a absolutely literal adaptation of the book was possible. I never imagined it would make a very interesting movie or even a very doable movie to make a literal adaptation of the book. So I was always open to the idea of an interpretive adaptation, which this very certainly was. And I think it's a brilliant movie. I was first uncomfortable about being portrayed at all, because that was not ever in my plans when I sold the option. I never thought, oh good, I'll be a character in a movie. You know, quite the opposite. And when they first approached me about it, I had said no. In other words, I said, go ahead and make a movie from my book, but I don't want to be in it. And then over time, I was persuaded to reconsider, and I'm glad I did. And I, of course, feel like once I knew that Meryl Streep was going to be playing me, I thought, well, it can't go wrong. She'll be great, and I don't have to worry. And she was.
Except that she becomes a very bad girl for a part of that film. Did that feel strange?
Yes, but the movie takes a turn into the imaginative.
Absolutely.
Very powerfully so. And I think anybody who kind of understands creative process knows that that's not likely to be real, and it certainly isn't.
Yes, I think so too. But it must have been a little bit of a shocker to see that character suddenly be a totally different person than you. And so you also had an article called Life Swell that inspired the movie Blue Crush. And in that case, what was your experience?
Well, that was much more of a typical experience of the piece was optioned, and I was sent this script to read just to give them sort of feedback on it, and then they made the movie. And then I went and saw the movie. So I wasn't involved in any way. And I was very pleased with it. I thought they did a great job. And I'm very proud of it. I'm proud that it inspired, that my story inspired a movie that is a really good movie. It's a very well-made movie, and I'm really happy to be associated with it.
And it certainly focuses attention on this group of people, young female surfers. And there are many, I thought, moments in the movie where we get to feel what their lives are like. And I'm sure that was also part of your experience with those surfers when you were doing your article.
Yes, and I felt like the movie really maintained what was very important in the story to me, which is a sense of their lives as young women trying to make it in what was very much a male-dominated kind of universe, and just contending with the aspirations of being young and having this talent and maturing to a point of trying to figure out what that really meant.
Right.
And I think the movie really maintain that, and while they had to add in some Hollywood elements of romance and so forth, I'm very pleased with the fact that they really kept true to that aspect of the story, and I'm very, very happy about it.
I'm glad to hear that because I like the movie a lot, and your article, which is still available online, as is the Orchid Thief article for The New Yorker. So before we end today, which has to be unfortunately soon, is there a question you wish I had asked you or anything you want to say about work coming up?
Oh, well, I have a few things that just are I'm happy to mention, which, first of all, I have two projects that I'm proud of that I've been doing that are a little bit different from my usual. One is that I have a podcast that I'm doing with a friend, Sarah Thayer, called Cry Babies, and it's been really fun, where we're talking about books and music and movies and various things that bring us to tears, and we've had some really interesting guests, so that's been a lot of fun.
And how do people find the podcast?
It's on iTunes. It's free. You just go to Cry Babies. It's also, if you go to Earwolf, EARWOLF.com, that's our producer, and look for Cry Babies, and you can subscribe. I have a class online through Skillshare.com. That's SKILLSHARE.com, on writing creative nonfiction. And that's been very gratifying to have done that course. It's a video course. You self-pace through 10 lessons. And I really enjoyed the fact that people seem to have gotten something out of it. It's very gratifying when you can turn around and teach something that you do for as long as I've been doing it, and feel like it has maybe helped some people in their own writing career.
Well, Susan, thank you so much. Certainly what we've talked about, I'm sure, will help a lot of people out here listening to KPTZ. And I'm going to go right home and look up those two sources, your podcast and Skillshare work. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Sheila. Nice talking to you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, writingitreal.com/audio.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Production coordinator is Mike Schlexer.